This is Cliff Readers on the Law Show, WXPI FM radio, Williamsport, Pennsylvania, community radio, independent radio for open minds. And today, this is Cliff Readers interviewing Keith Stroup of an organization called Normal. Now, Keith, I've got to tell you that you were already something of a celebrity when I graduated from Georgetown Law School in 1973, and I went in as a clerk for the federal system. But I recall you, people were talking about you even then. So maybe what you could do is tell us a little bit about your personal history and the history of Normal.
Sure, Cliff, my pleasure, and I assure you I'm not a celebrity, but I understand the point you were making. I was probably a little more progressive or out of bounds than most of my colleagues who were graduating Georgetown Law School when I graduated in 1968. Well, the history of Normal really is tied, or to the establishment of Normal, is tied to the Vietnam War, and in particular to the anti-war movement. As I say, I graduated Georgetown at the height of the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement, 1968. And as you will recall, back then, there was no lottery. Back then, any male who was not a full-time student but was over 18 years of age would be drafted, and I mean drafted within a few weeks of dropping out of school. So that was an incentive, of course, that kept lots of us. Once we graduated college, we immediately started signing up for some version of grad school, because otherwise you were going to be drafted and sent to Vietnam. I went to Georgetown, and when I got out, I was still too young to avoid the draft. I was 27, and you could be drafted until you were 29. So I went to see some National Lawyers Guild lawyers, a wonderful organization. If your listeners have not heard from them, they really are a terrific group that comes to the aid of dissidents whenever there's a controversy around the country. And back then, they were spending a lot of their time providing advice to those people who wanted to avoid the war, draft evaders, I think we were called at the time. And they gave me three options. They said they could put me in touch with some psychiatrists in Baltimore, and I live in Washington, D.C., so that was close, who would say that I was gay. And back then, If someone said they were gay, it wasn't don't ask, don't tell. You just simply were not eligible for the military.
Right.
And I actually thought that was kind of an interesting option, but I was married with a small child, and my wife at the time just would not hear of that, which I find kind of fascinating. But at any event, I think her position was rather dead than gay. It used to be they talked about rather dead than red. At any event, she was uncomfortable with my claiming to be gay, so I passed on that option. They also offered to put me in touch with people in Canada, because back then, a lot of people who were wanting to avoid the draft simply fled the country, and Canada had always been a kind of an open country to allow people from the U.S. to migrate up there and live up there. The problem with that option was that there was no guarantee you would ever be allowed to return. And while I certainly was opposed to the war and didn't want to go to Vietnam, I also didn't want to forever leave the United States. So that wasn't terribly appealing. And the third option they came up with was I had been hired just as I was finishing up law school. I got a job offer from a presidential commission called the National Commission on Product Safety. And it was a commission that had been established primarily through the work of former Senator Warren Magnuson out of Washington State. But it was due to the work of Ralph Nader. Ralph had come to town and had kind of announced himself as a public interest lawyer working on auto safety. He had published a book, Unsafe at Any Speed, about the old Corvair. And as a result, they created this commission, and I was hired along with, I think there was one other Georgetown lawyer and two Harvard lawyers on the staff. And our job was to identify unsafe products used in and around the house and to schedule public hearings where we could then build a record and encourage Congress to pass laws to protect the consumer. Now, again, I wasn't that interested in product safety, but it was an option rather than going to the war, and I ended up with what's called a critical skills deferment, and again, with the help of these national professional lawyers, Guild lawyers, where I was allowed to spend the 2 years I would have been in Vietnam working for this presidential commission at 16th and K in downtown Washington, D.C., not far from where the normal office is today as well. So I had become somewhat radicalized by the war, the anti-war demonstrations, and when I would go to these demonstrations, there was a lot of marijuana smoking back then. It was a kind of a symbol, a way to protest the war in Vietnam, and also to let the government know that there were some other things we didn't like about their policies, and one of them was the marijuana prohibition.
But I could just interrupt you for a second. Well, you were contemporary with Joan Claybrook and Bill Dobrevere in D.C. in that time frame?
I was slightly ahead of Joan. I was here during the first two groups of what were called Nader's Raiders, if you remember.
Yeah.
And what they were, each year, the first couple of years Ralph came to town, he would bring usually four, sometimes six or eight, but usually four recent law graduates from Princeton and Harvard and other, you know, top schools, and they would come down and spend a couple of years working around Ralph and helping him in his crusade for product safety. And I became friends with those first two groups of Nader's Raiders. We were totally contemporaries. We graduated law school about the same time. So, yes, it was during that time, and what influenced me was, having spent that couple of years working around Nader, I was introduced to this concept of public interest law. I had never really heard of the idea of public interest law. I had always presumed that you graduate law school and you go back to your hometown and practice law and get rich, etc. But public interest law is simply using your law school experience and skills to try to impact public policy instead of trying to help individual clients. And that had a lot of appeal to me, but the issue that was important to me, because I first smoked marijuana when I was a freshman at Georgetown Law School. I always like to include that, and I know Georgetown's very proud of that. So when you talk about a mini celebrity, I think it was simply because I was out front about my marijuana use, and most law graduates back then were obviously not willing to be honest about that because they were concerned that it might hurt the career, etc.
Right.
So I ended up founding Normal, establishing Normal as a public interest lobby to represent marijuana smokers in late 1970, and it was entirely a result of the experience I'd had working around Ralph Nader and the fact that I had been somewhat radicalized by the war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I that's kind of how I recollect it. When I was in D.C., I always had part-time jobs. I needed to work, and I worked for one of the Nader organizations, and that's why I said you were legendary. I sort of remember hearing that. And then I wound up working for the lawyer who represented the men who broke into the Watergate. So, Henry Rothblatt. So I was around a lot of those same people, and, you know, you were somebody. The whole idea of public interest law was really percolating then. And like you, I decided, I kind of made a little different path that I thought, well, maybe I could be in private practice and do public interest work, you know, kind of on the side or at the same time. And I've been able to do that, and it's been, you know, just really wonderful. So, you know, and really what you were doing was, whether you knew it or not, an inspiration to others in terms of serving the public, you know.
Well, that's very generous of you to say. By the way, do you remember John Esposito and Mark Silverman?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I can't remember some of the other names of the people I was friends with at the time because it's been a long time ago, about 48 years ago or something. But the original Nader's Raiders were all pretty friendly towards legalizing marijuana, and the majority of them were privately were marijuana smokers too. Now Ralph wasn't. As you knew Ralph, you know he's a straight arrow, and I doubt that he ever even saw marijuana. But the Nader's Raiders that worked for him in those first few years when he came to town were certainly familiar with marijuana.
yeah, I'm sure. I recall that as well. So once you formed the organization, you know, what was its early history? I mean, for how long was it regarded as something, you know, sort of crazy, a bunch of druggies wanting to justify their own use as opposed to, you know, really developing a mainstream kind of following?
Well, I think the biggest break we had was in the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, and as you may recall, because of a constitutional challenge to the prior federal drug law, and the Supreme Court had held that provisions of that were unconstitutional. The Congress had a period there in 1970 when they had a lot of pressure to adopt a new anti-drug law, and President Nixon naturally was mostly shaping that law, and it was not something that most of us would approve of. It was more war on drugs and mandatory penalties and lock people up, etc. However, at that same time, Congressman Ed Koch primarily, although he had a little help from a few other members of Congress, but the fellow who later became a mayor of New York for several terms, but he was a liberal congressman from New York at the time. And I had gotten to know him and another congressman from New York named Jim Scheuer and a few other people who were sympathetic to ending marijuana prohibition. So Ed Koch managed to get a provision in the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, which remains today still our primary anti-drug act. He got a provision included to establish the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse. Now, it was a commission that Nixon appointed 9 of the members, Congress appointed 4 of the members. So we weren't expecting a lot because, you know, frankly, people that former President Nixon would appoint, we presumed we're going to share his anti-drug views, and we didn't expect a lot out of the report. It was, the commission was headed by former Pennsylvania Governor Raymond Schaefer, in fact, and it turns out, we didn't know at the time, but Raymond Schaefer, you know, like a lot of governors around the country, had kids, and his kids had experimented with marijuana, and he realized it was no big deal, and he certainly didn't want them treated like criminals. So after a year of that work of that commission, they came out with their first report called Marijuana, a Signal of Misunderstanding in 1972. And it was sort of a half a loaf. It did not recommend legalization, full legalization where you would have a legal supply of marijuana. So we were disappointed. But what it did was it at least recognized that we should stop arresting responsible marijuana smokers. And since about 90% of the arrests that occur in this country back then, as well as today, involve an ounce or less of marijuana, we realized that if we could at least decriminalize marijuana, which is the term that began to be used for that half a loaf recommendation, that would be a major step forward. But the commission went out of business once they issued their report. They didn't have any provisions for a group that would try to stay busy and implement those acts. So starting in 1972, Normal began to go around the country and provide witnesses for any state legislator who would be willing to introduce a bill that would implement the recommendations of the commission, and that is to stop treating minor marijuana offenses as a crime. The first state to do that was Oregon in 1973, and between 73 and 78, we managed to get 11 states to adopt decriminalization, and equally as important, we managed to lower the penalties, even though we didn't get full decriminalization, in almost every state in the country, including states like Texas and Oklahoma, where at the time they were locking people up for 10 and 20 years sometimes for if they were caught with just an ounce or two of marijuana. So I would say that once we began to get states to adopt decriminalization laws, and as I say, that began in 1973, Normal became far more mainstream than we were the first 2 or 3 years. Initially, when I tried to testify before the Marijuana Commission, they basically told me they weren't interested in hearing from me. You know, they didn't know anything about Normal, and they didn't know whether to take it seriously or not. I ended up going to former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who had become a friend. I had approached Ramsey when I was thinking about starting Normal because I had read a book he had written called Crime in America, and I think it came out in 1970, in which he called for legalizing marijuana. And I was amazed. I mean, here was this former attorney general who was that current regarding marijuana and marijuana laws, so I managed to get to see him. And I asked him, in fact, I said, does this make sense, or am I taking some foolish step? I didn't want to destroy my future by doing something that was too radical. And Ramsey was very influential to me in making that decision. He actually told me that, number one, I should do it because it was an important issue and someone needed to take it on. And secondly, he said you should do it now while you're young so that if, in fact, it doesn't work and if you fall on your face, you can get up and still... you can still have a good life and a good career, whereas he said when you get older, you can't really take risks like that because you'll have family obligations and other reasons why it's hard to do. So I went to Ramsey Clark and said, Ramsey, the Marijuana Commission says they're not interested in hearing from Normal. Would you be willing to testify for us? And he said, of course I would. So I went back to the Marijuana Commission and said, well, I've got former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Well, they weren't hearing anything about it. They basically said, we don't want to hear from you, and we don't want to hear from Ramsey Clark. Well, I went to the media at that point. I went to Jack Anderson, who at the time had a big gossip column in the Washington Post. Right. And once he ran the story saying the Marijuana Commission was not interested in hearing from Ramsey Clark or from Normal, within a few days, both Ramsey had been invited to testify before the commission, and so had I. So once we had established ourselves as a legitimate voice entitled to participate in the decision-making, or at least into the policy-making that was ongoing, from then on, I think Normal was generally taken seriously.
That's interesting. Has progress been uniform? Because I recall, of course, that initially there seemed to be acceptance of the idea of at least decriminalization, but it seems like it kind of went into a hiatus, a winter sleep for 15 years.
It did indeed, and at the time we couldn't figure out what had happened. As they say, we won 11 states we convinced them to pass decriminalization laws between 73 and 78. Nebraska was the last of the 11 in 78. And at that time, we assumed we were on a roll. We thought sometime in the next 5 years or so, we're probably going to stop arresting smokers all across the country. Well, we discovered that the public mood can change on social issues, and sometimes in a fairly short period of time. Now, today, we can look back at the Gallup polls, just for a little reference point. Gallup first asked the question to the American public of, do you favor legalizing marijuana, for the first time in 1969, the year before we founded Normal. And at that time, only 12% of the American public supported legalization, 88% opposed it. So obviously we were running against the current at that time. But what do those Gallup surveys show over a period of time was we continued to pick up support gradually through 1979. And at that point, for reasons that God only knows, you had Ronald Reagan coming on and Just Say No, and Nancy Reagan and her anti-drug campaign, and the parents groups began to raise the issue of, well, what about the kids, as if we shouldn't legalize anything for adults unless it was appropriate for kids. I've always found that to be a fascinating argument, because if you really believe that, then adults wouldn't be able to have sex or drive cars or get married or skydive or
drink alcohol,
motorcycles. But no one would want to live in a world like that. But in any event, at the time, the country really did become more conservative, and for a period of 18 years, we did not win another statewide victory. That is, from 1978 until 1996, when California was the first state to legalize medical marijuana, we didn't win a single victory. Now, we did manage to hold on to those 11 states where we had decriminalized minor offenses, but you can imagine that it's very difficult to keep a public interest organization alive when you're not making any progress that you can show people. So it was a very difficult 18 years, but when you look at the Gallup polls, what you see is about 90, the polls started coming back in our direction, and they have been increasingly supportive ever since. And frankly, about 2 years ago was the first time we ever showed majority of support favoring legalization nationwide. And in the last year or two, we've had a series of three or four National polls showing as high as 58%, the latest Gallup was 58% support for full legalization nationwide, which means that on the East and West Coast, you have higher because obviously we have less support in the Midwest from the South.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, last month we interviewed a Pennsylvania Senator, Eugene Yaw, who would be perceived, I think, as a conservative Republican, although his wife went to Georgetown, Ann Pepperman, wonderful woman. he's a reasonable guy. And in the interview, he said to me that he has never seen a political issue move as quickly as reform of marijuana laws right now here today. He said in a month, there has been a cataclysmic change in perceptions in the Pennsylvania legislature in 6 months. And so I wonder what you attribute that. I think he's probably a pretty good canary in the mine, on that issue.
I think the single most important thing that's happened, I would say two things. One is the medical marijuana issue was very helpful in causing people to rethink their position towards marijuana. Prior to that, most older Americans had lived through the Reefer Madness era, and it was very difficult for them to evaluate marijuana policy rationally. They had heard their whole life that it was a killer drug, that it led to heroin, etc., and they just didn't feel comfortable changing policy. But once medical marijuana began to be accepted in a few states around the country, you had to deal with this issue. Now, wait a minute. If marijuana is sometimes a life-saving drug for people with cancer or AIDS or MS or Crohn's or a lot of other serious diseases, then it's hard to also justify that it's a killer drug or that it's a reefer madness. So I think the growth or acceptance generally of the medical use of marijuana softened up a lot of our opponents and caused them to rethink their position on marijuana. Now, what really has changed things, and as the elected official from Pennsylvania was talking about just in the last year or so, is that in November of 2012, we won full legalization initiatives in both Colorado and Washington, where not only have they stopped arresting smokers, and not only do they allow patients who get a doctor's recommendation to use it, but anyone who's 21 years of age or older is allowed to use marijuana, and there are legal dispensaries that you can go buy it at, just similar to how you would go buy alcohol. Well, when that happened, I think it was an enlightened event for most Americans. They had always thought of legalizing marijuana as kind of a fanciful proposal, but not one that was very realistic. And indeed, most of my friends would say, Keith, I agree with you, but that's never going to happen in my lifetime. Well, guess what? It has happened in two states in our lifetime, and it's probably going to happen in two more states this coming November, and by 2016, I would imagine we'll have another four or five states. So what's happened is marijuana legalization now is being considered by lots of elected officials as a possible policy option, where in the past they never felt it was realistic. So our support continues to grow, and if it continues to grow for another 3 or 4 years, I don't think there's any way that our opponents could ever turn this policy around.
Let me just reintroduce you. I have a lot more questions. This is Cliff Readers on the Law Show, WXPI FM, and I'm speaking with Keith Stroup, a founder of Normal, National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, and Georgetown law graduate. Again, thank you for your time. I think we'll probably be able to fill our time very usefully here. Last month, when we were talking about pharmaceuticals, I talked with Sid Wolf of Public Citizen.
Sure.
And Dr. Jerome Kasserer, who was actually editor of the New England Journal of Medicine and teaches up at Harvard. And, we got to talk about medical marijuana, and I raised this issue with them, too. Hasn't this really changed the equation? You know, like scientists that they are, and I don't want to exactly characterize what they were saying because, I don't want to be inaccurate. But they were very careful to say that while they certainly didn't oppose reform of marijuana laws, the jury was still out on the question as to whether there was a medical benefit, notwithstanding the considerable That there's certainly considerable individual experiences. People with MS have told stories or this or that, but in terms of large-scale studies, the kinds of things that people look at who are in that field who are medical doctors, and I have to tell you, I'm a member of the Patient Safety Authority, instituted by the Institute of Medicine. So, I deal with a lot of doctors and scientists. They look at empirical data. Is it true that while we have a lot of apocryphal stories that, in terms of medical benefits, that's still not really very clear?
Well, I think what is accurate to say is because the federal government refuses to do research on the potential positive benefits from marijuana. And by the way, the head of NIDA actually is quoted in the New York Times just a year or so ago as saying precisely that. They do not approve research. If a researcher approaches them and says, I hear it helps on MS, or I hear it helps on cancer, or Crohn's disease, they simply won't approve the research, and they won't provide the marijuana. And you can't do research in this country on marijuana unless you get it approved by NIDA, by DEA, and by FDA, and you have to use the marijuana from the University of Mississippi. It's grown by the federal government for research purposes. So what's happened is almost all of the research on the medical uses of marijuana has occurred out of this country. There's a lot of terrific research that's come out of Israel, for example. They have one of the most advanced medical research programs in the world. And also there was a short time, there was about 8 or 9 years, when the University of California had their own program. And they spent about $10 million over, I think, 8 or 9 years. And they also came up with some very positive research on marijuana. So I would agree with Sid Wolf and others who say this is not a drug that's been studied to the extent that prescription drugs get studied when they go through the FDA approval process, but that's because our own government will not allow it to happen. So now what they're doing, after having sat on their hands and refused to approve the research, they now come along and say, oh, well, there's not adequate research. Well, that's a circular argument. Now, the reality is this. I think most people are aware of the two programs Sonia Grupa has done for CNN. He is a physician who was adamantly opposed to marijuana and the medical use of marijuana until he took the time to get to know some of these parents who have children who have what's called Dravet syndrome. So they have multiple seizures a day, some of them up to 100 seizures a day. And obviously they can't learn, that some of them can't even speak. Their life is destroyed. And traditional medication is not very effective to treat it. Well, what he discovered is for some of these families who had taken the risk of moving to the state of Colorado, where high CBD or cannabidiol marijuana is available, that oftentimes using the kids, when they're young kids, they don't smoke it, of course, but they convert it into oils and salves and stuff, and they put the oil either under the tongue or sometimes they even use it on the skin, that some of these young children who might have 60 seizures a day, now maybe they have 2 or 3 seizures a week. I am an epileptic. I first started having seizures when I was 65 years old, and mine are under control with traditional medication, but I understand how important it would be if you had a child who suffered from this condition, and only marijuana would help it. And again, if anyone saw either of those two CNN specials over the last few months, I would bet that you would no longer say marijuana has not been proven to have medical use. It has not been through all of the research that pharmaceutical drugs go through, but you cannot listen to those parents and conclude that they should not be allowed to offer that medicine to their children.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question about, when people talk about medical marijuana, and Senator Yaw actually pointed this out, he sort of made a demarcation between recreational use, where people like to get high, who also like to drink a couple of glasses of wine now and then, versus medical use, which he pointed out, medical use can be accomplished without the substance that makes somebody high. And, yet I've talked to other people who said, no, without that substance, you don't get the full effect. Now, you mentioned Israel. We were there in January and visited one of the marijuana farms. And what's interesting about Israel is they have one of the, I saw a report, one of the lowest recreational uses in the world, and yet the drug is legal for, you know, if you have a headache, you can get, it's very easy to get marijuana, it's like sort of like California for medical usage, and yet the use is actually quite low in that country. But they've apparently developed a form of marijuana that enables them to get the benefits of THC, but at the same time, the person does not get high from it. What is, in terms of the development of marijuana for medical usages, I mean, is it really kind of an excuse to get high for some people, or is there really a demarcation between how we use the drug?
I think, by the way, the confusion that a lot of people have regarding the two divisions of medical use and recreational use has to do with the California model. The California medical use law is a joke. It is written in such a manner that anyone can qualify, and they have what are called pot docs out there, doctors who don't even examine you, but if you'll go in and pay them $100 or $150, they'll give you a recommendation, even if you tell them that if you're a woman and you wear high heels and your feet hurt, that's good enough. You can get a recommendation for medical marijuana. So most of us have seen now for several years pictures on the evening news of healthy-looking young men, usually, coming out of these so-called medical dispensaries in California, and it's clear that they're scamming the system. There are seriously ill patients who benefit from the system in California, but there are also, I think, a majority of the users in California who are scamming the system. They're gaming the system. Normal's position has always been we need to keep the two issues totally separate. People who suffer from a serious illness who would benefit from the medical use of marijuana should clearly have it available. And in the 20 states that have followed California, what they've done is they've tightened up the system. For example, the District of Columbia just in the last year has finally legalized medical marijuana. We have our first two or three, I think three dispensaries that have opened. There, you can't have a pot doc. The only doctor that can recommend it has to be a physician that you've seen for, I think it's 6 months or longer, or your general care physician, and it's a very limited list of conditions or diseases for which the doctor can recommend it. And that's what it should be. Seriously ill patients need medical marijuana, but those of us who smoke recreationally should work to change the law so that we can smoke recreationally legally, but we should not muck up the medical use system by faking an illness. In addition, the position Normal has always taken is that we're really only incidentally talking about marijuana. We're really talking about personal freedom, and that is that we think the government has no business coming into our homes to find out what music we listen to, what books we read, how we conduct ourselves in the bedroom, or whether we smoke marijuana or drink alcohol when we relax in the evening. It simply is none of their business. And so we don't win that point by faking illness and paying a pot doc so we don't get arrested. What we need to do is what we've done in Colorado and Washington is to continue to work to convince our elected officials that there's no justification for treating responsible marijuana smokers as criminals, but we should not confuse the medical use issue with the recreational marijuana issue.
That's very, very interesting on your part, because, you know, what a lot of people say to me, legislators I've talked to in Pennsylvania, is they see medical use as a gateway to recreational use, and they're okay with that. I'm talking about liberal, metropolitan city representatives and senators, and they're okay with it being a gateway, because they say, well, that way, you know, we introduce the public to the fact that, you know, it's not some terrible thing. So that fact that Normal takes that position is, that's the first thing you said that really surprised me about your position. Let me just reintroduce you again. This is Cliff Readers on The Law Show talking with Keith Stroup, founder of Normal on WXPI FM radio, community radio in Williamsport. I want to talk to you a little bit about the history of marijuana laws. I remember talking to my dad about this once, and he was born and raised in New York City on Broadway, as was his father and grandfather, so we had a lengthy presence in Manhattan. And my father said at one time it was legal, and he remembers growing up in the early, I guess, in the 20s, that you know, it was fairly common. What is the history of the illegalization of marijuana?
Well, first off, the federal law making marijuana illegal was not passed until 1937. So, in some states and under federal law, you were allowed to smoke it. A lot of medicines included it. It was just, you know, it was a personal choice of whether you smoked marijuana or not. But some states began, I think California may have been the first state to pass a state anti-marijuana law, and I think it was around 1905, something like that. And by the time the federal government made it illegal in 37, the majority of the states had already passed some state laws. And the reason was, most middle-class Americans were simply not familiar with marijuana at all. It was a drug that was primarily used by Mexican-American migrant workers that would come into the United States, and of course they didn't have any representation among our elected officials at the time, and among black jazz musicians. It used to be that the jazz culture kind of worked its way from New Orleans up to Chicago and then out to New York and other parts of the country. And marijuana became known as something used by jazz musicians who were predominantly black Americans and by migrant farm workers, and neither was very popular at the time. And so the federal government simply took advantage of that lack of familiarity to convince the country that marijuana was an evil substance, and that the only answer to that evil substance was to prohibit it. Now that's strange when you realize that we had just been through alcohol prohibition.
Right.
We realized after only about 11 or 12 years that alcohol prohibition was a failure, that prohibition was causing more problems than alcohol itself. And so the country had re-legalized alcohol, yet within just a few years, we had gone back to prohibition as an option for marijuana. If marijuana would have been popular with middle-class mainstream Americans in the 30s, I assure you, we would never have made it illegal, but it wasn't. And so it has taken, what happened is after the, you know, after 75 years of prohibition, there had built up this presumption that it must be a terribly dangerous drug or otherwise it wouldn't be prohibited. You know, it's sort of self-fulfilling promise. So it has taken us all of these decades to overcome that negative stereotype of the marijuana smoker as some sort of someone on the fringes of society. A marijuana smoker today, and that's been the case now since the 60s and 70s, you can't tell one's political persuasion or economic status just because they smoke marijuana. Marijuana smokers come in all shapes and sizes and all political persuasions. But, of course, that was not always the case. I mean, for example, we talked about the anti-Vietnam years. While I found it reinforcing that when I would go to anti-Vietnam War rallies in the late 60s and early 70s, and there was a lot of open marijuana smoking, in fact, a lot of my contemporaries and people who were older found that as a bad thing. They supported the war in Vietnam, and when they would see pictures on the news of a long-haired anti-war activist burning his draft card in the park, he was often also smoking a joint. And so for a long time, marijuana smoking in the 70s and 80s and 90s, a lot of older Americans associated as kind of anti-American, unpatriotic. And so we had to overcome all of that before we could finally get to the point where we can have an honest public debate about marijuana policy. And I think we're there now.
That's very interesting. So let's talk about issues that opponents raise. One of the ones when we've talked to people is they say, well, there's a smoke issue. People we know from cigarettes. That taking smoke into one's lungs is dangerous, causes cancer, and at the very least, there ought to be appropriate warnings like there are for cigarettes. What is the smoke issue?
Well, number one, I think all of us would agree that taking any smoke into your lungs is probably not a healthful practice, and so there's a certain amount of common sense involved in that. But there's two responses to that. Number one, there are other ways to enjoy marijuana that do not involve bringing smoke into your lungs. For example, you can vaporize it, which is something that's become more and more popular with medical use patients, because for some of them, like some MS patients, they have to smoke marijuana several times a day. And they don't want to, you know, they don't want to take all that smoke into their lungs. So they vaporize it, where you heat the temperature of the marijuana almost to the burning point, but not quite. And the result is that you get most of the effects you're looking for from the marijuana, but you don't get the carcinogenic aspects that would result if you were burning the marijuana. Now, the other point is this. Excuse me. Most marijuana smokers, and I put myself in this category, at most, We smoke half a joint in the evening when we're relaxing and watching the news. I know when I get home at the end of the day, if I'm not traveling, I usually pour a glass of wine, roll a joint, and turn on the evening news. So you're smoking, you know, say a half a cigarette once a day at most, and for a lot of people just on the weekends. If you could limit your tobacco smoking to only on the weekends or only a half a cigarette in the evening, your risk of cancer would be negligible. The problem is tobacco is a very addictive substance. So once you start smoking it, you tend to increase your smoking as you go along. So, yes, it is not the most helpful practice in the world to bring smoke into your lungs, but there is not a single study that shows that marijuana smoke is carcinogenic, and there have been lots of attempts to prove that. So far, they haven't shown it. It may be eventually they'll show that if you smoked enough marijuana, the smoke could be carcinogenic, but very few marijuana smokers smoke in the same manner as tobacco smokers smoke. Mm-hmm.
To get the benefit medically, I'm sort of going back to something you said earlier.
Sure.
The recombined marijuana that does not give the effect of a high, is it as effective as the ordinary marijuana that does give the user the high?
Well, see, let me just briefly for your listeners explain that while there are scores of active ingredients in marijuana, the two most important are THC and CBD. THC is tetrahydrocannabinol, and that's what recreational smokers get their high from. And so for years in this country, the marijuana that's been bred, the strains that have been developed, are very high in THC. And no one paid a lot of attention to CBD. There's always a little CBD in the marijuana, but people for a long time didn't realize how significant the CBD was, or the cannabidiol. Well, what we've discovered in the last few years is that many of the medical applications of marijuana depend on a high level of CBD, of cannabidiol. And cannabidiol does not get you high, but it also is not as effective in its medical application unless there is some THC also. So those states, and by the way, right now there are five or six of them that are in the process. I think three or four have already passed these laws, and two or three are still considering them. They're passing laws which essentially say if you can get out to Colorado or Washington and get a high CBD oil, and you can bring it back to our state and use it as long as it doesn't have THC in it, and we're not going to treat that as a crime in our state. Well, it simply won't be effective. You've got to have a certain level of THC, and it's called the entourage effect. In fact, Sonia Group on CNN dealt with that specifically in his second piece. So, although those attempts by these various Midwestern and Southern states to find a version of marijuana that's helpful for medical use but doesn't get you high, what they don't realize is the science doesn't support that. The CBD alone simply is not as effective as if it has low levels of THC in it. So, again, now what's happening is in states like Colorado, they are developing strains that have low levels of THC and high levels of CBD. And that's a terribly important step forward. And I think as more and more state legislators get more sophisticated about the science, they'll be less afraid to pass regular medical marijuana laws. What they're trying to do now, frankly, they're trying to offer some relief to some of these seriously ill patients, but they don't want you to get high. Now, that's an interesting concept. If you're a sick person, And if getting high makes you feel good, I'm not sure that's something to be avoided. Mm-hmm. When you're sick, what you're trying to do is feel better. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is to deal with the symptoms and the underlying cause of the illness, but part of it is feeling good, getting up and feeling good. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a misguided attempt to sort of enforce some sort of silly morality. It's okay to use marijuana as long as you don't get high.
As long as you don't enjoy it, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, this is Cliff Readers interviewing Keith Stroup on The Law Show, WXPI-FM Community Radio, 88.5 on your dial, Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Keith, so the next question that comes up when I talk to legislators is they say, well, Jerry Brown said it on TV the other day. He said, well, I'm not sure we, it was sort of funny the way he put it. He said, I'm not sure we want a lot of high legislators that have a hard enough time getting things done. So there's the concern that, well, drunk driving is a major problem, and I've been myself active in MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and, you know, there is a concern about impaired people on the roads. There are those who say, well, it's harder to test for marijuana use, that we already have, you know, 50,000 deaths a year on the roads, whatever. Do we really need any more? What do you say, and how do you deal with the concern that people will not be discreet in the use, just like they're not with alcohol, and that, you know, you have a whole nother societal cost in terms of irresponsible users?
Well, first off, I think there is an obligation that those of us who advocate for legalization, we must now use this new opportunity we have in states like Colorado and Washington to demonstrate that we can implement full legalization in a responsible manner. And that means primarily two things. It means that we must make sure that we educate marijuana smokers to the fact that you cannot drive that you should not drive when you're impaired from marijuana, just as you should not drive when you're impaired from alcohol. Now, some smokers recognize that, and all you need to really do is, if you simply wait about an hour to an hour and a half after you've smoked marijuana, the levels of THC in your system will be lower than 5 nanograms, and you will not be impaired. You can drive safely. But there are some smokers out there that have convinced themselves that you drive better when you're stoned. Well, that's simply not true, and the science doesn't support it. You drive better stoned than you do when you're drunk, because the types of mistakes you make when you're stoned are you drive more slowly, and you're not sure if you pass the turnpike exit you want or whether it's the next one coming up, so you accommodate that uncertainty by slowing down. With alcohol, the mistakes drivers make are aggressive mistakes. They speed, they pass on curves, and the mistakes tend to be deadly. Now, what's also important is to recognize that what you really don't want to do is combine alcohol and marijuana and drive, because the effects exacerbate each other. And if you do the two and drive, it's far worse than either alcohol alone or marijuana alone. But again, let me make this point. Sometimes when I hear legislators say, oh my goodness, if we legalize marijuana, we're going to have tens of thousands of new impaired drivers on the highway. Well, keep in mind that roughly 30 million Americans smoke marijuana at least once a year, and have for 20, 30 years. We have always been driving. Do people think we've been walking to work for the last 30 years? So you already have people on the road who are driving and who are marijuana smokers. The vast majority are responsible smokers. So if you smoke the evening before, or if you smoke on the weekend, that's not going to affect your driving the next day or when you go to work on Monday. But nonetheless, we have an obligation to educate our own folks, the folks who do enjoy smoking marijuana, and to make sure they realize that what we don't want to do is allow there to be a big uptick in the numbers of impaired drivers on the road. People have a right not to have safe roads.
Do the police have means now, methods to test for marijuana use?
Well, it's not as effective as it should be. What they have is they often use the same roadside sobriety test they use with alcohol. It's sometimes called the DRE test, but that's very subjective. What they end up doing is if they see you driving in an erratic manner or you appear to be impaired, they first presume it's alcohol, and if you test negative for alcohol, they will then usually take you into the station and draw a blood sample, and they measure for THC in your blood. And again, what most of the research seems to show is that up to 5 nanograms, there's really no impairment. And that means, you know, given an hour, hour and a half after you smoke. But if you got higher than 5 nanograms, most people should not be driving. Now, where it gets a little confusing is that if you're a regular smoker, for example, an MS patient who smokes several times a day, you may always have 5 nanograms or higher of THC in your blood, but you have learned to accommodate that. And so the research shows that the more experienced smokers can probably drive perfectly fine at higher levels of THC. So what we really need to develop, and the government, the federal government should have done this years ago, but they chose not to, we need to develop an impairment test, not a test that simply measures the presence of THC. That works on the margins. You know, if you've got somebody who tests positive with 20 nanograms of THC, then without question they're too impaired to be driving. But there are lots of people who drive perfectly well at 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 nanograms of THC. We should not be treating those people as if they're drunk drivers when in fact they're not. So again, we need to develop an impairment test that hopefully could be done by a police officer on the side of the road. And if in fact somebody's impaired, then we treat them the same as we treat drunk drivers. But just because somebody has trace amounts of THC in their system, we should not be treating them as if they're a drunk driver. And unfortunately, there's about 8 or 10 states in which they have what are called zero tolerance per se laws. If you have any THC in your system, when you're pulled over by the police for a traffic violation, you're treated as drunk driver, even though if you're a regular smoker, you can have trace amounts in your blood for several weeks after you last smoked.
Up to 30 days. Yeah, I know when my son went for his Department of Homeland Security clearance for the Coast Guard to get his mariner's license, he was told that if he had smoked marijuana within 30 days, that would be enough to disqualify him. But let me jump to another topic. We have about 9 minutes left. Gateway to other drugs, particularly painkillers, something we hear a lot about. What's your response to that?
Well, it used to be in the the 60s and 70s and 80s, the argument was made that marijuana leads to heroin. It was not as sophisticated as the arguments they use today. And the reason they jumped to that conclusion is they would say, for example, I've interviewed lots of heroin addicts, and I've yet to find one who didn't smoke marijuana before they used heroin. Well, that may well be true, but you're looking at the wrong end of the problem. If you would have asked those heroin users if they had ever drunk alcohol or smoked cigarettes, you would have found that they had done those as well, and in fact, in most cases, they had done both cigarettes and alcohol before they did marijuana, and yet no one has ever claimed that smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol leads to heroin. In fact, the vast majority of marijuana smokers don't go on to anything. They simply smoke marijuana, and they may or may not also enjoy alcohol, but that's it. I've been smoking marijuana now for 48 years. I've never even seen heroin. I don't know what it looks like. That connection was sort of silly, but it was one that worked before the country began to get a little more sophisticated about marijuana. Today, what a lot of the research is showing is that marijuana is actually a substitute drug. In other words, people oftentimes smoke marijuana and drink less alcohol than they did, or take fewer OxyContin than they did. And in fact, the substitution is generally positive. The drugs that they are using marijuana in lieu of are far more dangerous than marijuana. So I don't think that argument is any longer very effective politically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's another component, in this discussion that comes up a lot, and I can't remember if it was Senator Yall mentioned this to me or some one of the other people I interviewed, who said, well, what's ultimately going to drive this is the tax benefit to the states. All the states are hungry for money. Federal government is, it's going to happen because they want the money. And they use, I guess, Colorado as an example. Do you think that might ultimately drive the reform of marijuana laws?
Without question, and the metaphor I like to refer to is when I was growing up, the only state in the country that had legal gambling was Nevada. Now, all the other states knew that they could make money from gambling, but it was kind of, gambling was, used to be considered sinful. It was misconduct. And so states were passing up the revenue because it seemed immoral to them. Well, over time, New Jersey legalized gambling, and then over time, other states. And today, almost every state in the country has some form of legalized gambling. In some states, it's actually quite fascinating, like Missouri. They don't allow legalized gambling on land, but it's perfectly legal if you go out on a riverboat on the Mississippi River. So, that's sort of an arbitrary distinction, I think. Well, what is happening with marijuana now is very much like what happened with gambling. Colorado ended up realizing, I think it was $5 million in taxes on the very first month marijuana was legalized. And their estimate is, because they're now opening more and more dispensaries, that they'll generate more than $100 million in taxes the very first year of legal marijuana in Colorado. You can imagine that, assuming Washington has a similar result, all of the states that are nearby are going to start saying, now, wait a minute, why am I allowing the residents of my state to drive 50 miles across into Colorado or Washington and spend their money and generate all that tax revenue for those states? Why are we not doing it ourselves? So I think we're just in that phase where those economic arguments, we've made them for years, but they never had much leverage, because if it was considered immoral or sinful or, you know, just bad conduct, the state didn't want to be making money off of it. Well, I think we've moved beyond that now, and I think, in fact, the economic argument will become probably the driving argument in the coming 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the future is? Do you believe that it's now almost a certainty that legalization of marijuana for medical and or recreational uses is a foregone conclusion? What is your prediction? You've worked on this all your life.
Well, I've learned to never say never. In other words, I thought in the late 70s that there was no turning back, that we were making such progress that it was only a matter of time and we would have marijuana legalized nationwide. Well, here we are four decades later, and we're only now beginning to fully legalize marijuana. So I'm realistic enough to understand that sometimes the public mood can change. But I will say this, it seems to me less and less likely, because we now have the benefit of these two states as an experiment. The other states can sit back and look at what's happening in Colorado and Washington and make their own judgment about whether that policy would make sense for their state. And if we, for the next 2, 3, 4 years, if we demonstrate that you can legalize marijuana in a responsible manner with minimal side effects to the state, I think without question we will end up with all 50 states having some version of legalization. Now, they won't be uniform. It's not going to be done at the federal level. The goal is get the federal government to back out of the picture and let the states experiment. And by the way, let me just quickly say, I think President Obama, we owe a lot to the fact that Obama and his Justice Department have elected, rather than to try to interfere with the implementation of the Colorado and Washington laws, they've actually issued a memoranda that had 8 points, and they said, if you will do this in a responsible manner, and they listed the 8 goals that you should pay attention to, then the federal government has agreed to stand back and let the states experiment. So that has been the biggest favor that he could have done to the legalization movement, and I think by the time we have a new administration, we will have demonstrated that legalization works, and I think there's no turning back.
Yeah. Well, that's probably so, and I think that every young person I've talked to would agree with you. The future is in the young people who are now coming up to vote, the people in their 20s and 30s. Really think it's outmoded. Well, anyway, this is Cliff Readers. We're about out of time. On the Law Show, we've been interviewing Keith Stroup, the founder of NORML, a national organization to reform marijuana laws, on WXPI Williamsport FM radio, 88.5 independent radio for open minds. Thank you very, very much. It's been extremely interesting. And now I know why. When I went to Georgetown, you are a legend. Indeed you are, and for good reason. So Thank you very much for your time, and you know, you're very explaining things very, very well and understandably. I'm sure the blog will get lots of comments, and if they pass them along to me, I'll pass them along to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks again, and be well. Take care. So that was Keith Stroop. Well, I, as I said in the beginning of the program, I remember Keith when I was at Georgetown. He was a few years ahead of me, and he was a legend then. He started this organization to reform marijuana laws, and here he is all these years later still working at it. Very interesting guy, thoughtful man, is testifying the subject, and let's hear your comments. I'm sure we'll have some interesting feedback. Thank you very much, and good night.